Hello, this is Peter Fisher, and this is episode 3 of Sequence 2, about your thesis.
I'll either have you a star to roam, because I can't be around you.
So tonight we're going to talk about your thesis, and if you're a postdoc or an assistant professor or, you know, someone aside from a graduate student, don't just tune out, because there's going to be plenty for everyone. But of course, this will be mostly focused on the graduate students writing their thesis. So I'm coming to you from the Hotel Santa Barbara in downtown Santa Barbara, and I have to say, Santa Barbara is a really happening place. I just flew in here from Slack to give a presentation about dark matter and whitricity to some alumni here. There's quite an active MIT club, and so I'm right here in the historic downtown, and it's really nice. Santa Barbara's kind of a happening place, so it's really nice to be here. There are lots of bars, and had a nice dinner out. Do miss my cat. She usually sits on my lap while I'm recording, but I'll make do. So tonight's topic is the writing of the thesis. Much of what I'm going to say is applicable to a senior thesis, which many undergraduates at MIT have to write. And what I want to do is just give some practical advice about how I view a thesis and how I think it's best to go about writing one. Now, I should make a little bit of a disclaimer. The way a PhD physics thesis is written is very different from the way, for example, a history thesis is written. The relationship between student and advisor is quite different, and in fact, I really just don't know very much about theses in the humanities, or even really very much outside of physics. Caveat emptor if you're not a physicist. The kind of most important thing about a thesis, the way to think about it, is that for the student, it is really their first, or generally, their first real attempt at scientific expression. It's a time when you kind of stop and summarize all of what you've done for several years in a major piece of work. And that piece of work, the thesis, is in your life forever. I mean, it's a watershed moment in your professional career. And my feeling is that it's very, very important that your thesis be well written and well formatted and really well thought out and represent a very good piece of work. I've seen in my time some absolutely dire theses because primarily because I don't think the advisor thought it was very important. And certainly I've had students say to me, "Oh, well, nobody reads my thesis." That's really not the point. The point is that the student, you, write your thesis. And it's really an exercise in bringing something to completion in as graceful and elegant way as possible. Now, what the practical upshot of this is that it's going to take you a while to write your thesis. And I, just in my own thinking, leave about 9 months from the time the thesis is sort of officially started to the time of the defense. And I think that's a pretty good average. I've had students who've done it much faster. I don't think I've had any who've taken much longer. Now, the initial stages of writing, of course, are kind of exploratory, and the work may still be in progress when this writing takes place. So It's not like you stop everything and then write for 9 months. The real push in the writing typically takes, I would say, between 3 and 5 months. And so one thing I generally like is for my students to have all of their data analysis done before that intensive phase of writing. When I worked on L3, I just saw some real disasters when the thesis was being written at the same time the data analysis was being done, and everything was on some accelerated schedule for some absurd reason. And, anyway, so kind of my first point, and this applies to advisors and students, is, you know, decide consciously when the thesis is going to start, and make sure that that is well in advance of when the defense needs to take place. Now, the length of the thesis is an interesting topic, and here I have to admit I'm really an outlier. I've always thought one of the most interesting and sort of intelligent things Sam Ting did is that he has a strict 25-page limit on the thesis for his students. And you know the way he talks. If a student cannot express himself in 25 pages, he has no business being a physicist. And I think that's really probably too extreme, but I think the sentiment is really very good, that as your first scientific statement, it really should be not a bloated work that includes everything in the kitchen sink, but really a very concise, readable statement about what you have done, with the emphasis on you and the emphasis on concise. So generally, when I sit down with a student, what I ask them to do is, and again, this is well in advance, is write an outline down to level 2. So there's kind of the top level, which are going to be the chapters, and then level 2 is the sections of the chapters. And we kind of work out the outline a little bit. usually we iterate it back and forth once or twice. And once that's done, we sit down and say, okay, how many pages is this? How many pages is that? And at the beginning, I tell the student, okay, you've got 40 pages. So you've got to choose what's really important to say and what's maybe not so important. Now, I don't really stick to the 40 pages. I think that's kind of silly to put a numerical value on it. But the thesis typically expands to, 70 or 80 pages. And, I think that's about right. My thesis was about 88 pages. Of course, it was a much different time. I was able, in my thesis, I explained everything about the experiment because it was a double beta decay experiment that was literally just 8 diodes. But I think 80 pages is really good because I think what I do not like my students to do, and here again I differ from probably most physics professors, but I don't like my students to spend a lot of time explaining something or describing something that they really weren't involved in. So, if for example, during L3, there was no need for each student to write or copy a full-bore description of the entire L3 detector. Now, you can't just leave that out, obviously, but, none of my students built L3, but I did ask them to describe each of the major components and give a few numbers characterizing its performance. The resolution, both the statistical and stochastic term, the efficiency, and give the rough dimensions. And, of course, provide, good references to the source material in each one of those things. Now, in general, or I think without exception, my students are also involved in the construction of hardware. They don't just do data analysis. And I think it's very important that, that those things be described, but it should be in an appendix so that it's there if somebody needs to look at it. It's very extensively worked, but it's not part of the main body. Now, I really think a thesis should be a story. It should explain the motivation, the design, and the execution. But it really should rely heavily on narrative. So I think it's really a good idea for somebody writing a thesis to get a copy of Strunk and White, which is now Strunk, White, and Kallman, and read it. You know, this is the Elements of Style book, which you had in high school and probably never ever want to think about again. But, you know, now is really the good time to think about it, because you want to do a really good job writing your thesis, if for no other reason, so that, you know, when you're cleaning out a shelf somewhere in 7 or 8 years and you find your thesis, that you don't just go, ugh, and associate a, you know, really negative feeling with it. You want to feel like it's something that you did well. And I recently looked at my PhD thesis, and it is something I'm proud of. So you should take the time and go through the effort to make your thesis something you're really proud of, and not something that you just have to do. Typically, once a student of mine has the outline, we sit down and make up a writing schedule. And this is probably where there's the greatest deviation from student to student. My most recent student, Gray Ribkin, just went, you know, he made up a writing schedule and more or less stuck to it. Of course, there were a lot of changes, and as time passed, he thought he could explain things better. But, you know, he was only, you know, a few weeks off, maybe. And like a lot of the things we've talked about on this podcast, the writing schedule is not something cast in stone in general. In some specific instance, it is. And it is something that, you know, you should really try to stick to. Anyway, I found if a student makes a good level 2 outline, then kind of half the battle is won. Then the thesis has been broken up into 15 to 25 constituent parts, each of which are going to be a page or so long. And then as far as the writing goes, the students can just chip away at it. You know, a couple hundred lines of code a week, a corrected draft this week. You know, so I think that's a good way to do it. And the writing schedule should, I mean, typically for me, encompasses something like 7 months, because I think that's how long it takes to do a really good idea. Now, I mean, a big place where physics might differ from, for example, history is that, in my experience, no thesis advisor will let a student defend a thesis that isn't ready. It's just crazy. So this is a consideration in amongst all the hullabaloo and running around finishing your thesis. Is this work really ready to go? And I almost never schedule a thesis defense until the student and I have agreed that the thesis is pretty much in its final form. That doesn't mean everything's corrected and all of the figures, but that we've agreed on what the content of the thesis is and what's going to be said and what the result is. So this differs from, I think, some students in theoretical physics and maybe certainly in the humanities. The advisor might not really have a clear idea of what the student's been doing until he or she gets the thesis, and then this comes out at the defense, and I think there's some chance that people fail.
thesis defenses in the humanities. But that's just a different culture. So one of the things that's really key in producing a good thesis is good communication between the student and the advisor early on as possible. And this is going to be different, obviously, for every student and every advisor, but you have to make it happen. Otherwise, you know, you could do a lot of work and then find out that it's all for naught. Now, the advisor's role in all of this is really exactly what the title implies, advising. Certainly my feeling is that in terms of how things are said, the logic, and so on, the advisor plays a guiding role. This is not the advisor's work, and it's incumbent on the advisor to allow the student to say what their view is in the way they want to do it, rather than the way the advisor wants it expressed. Clearly, there has to be some agreement on what the result is. Agreement on what the student is going to say the result is. The advisor may have a different opinion, and that's fine, but the advisor has to support what the student's conclusions are. Now, many students find the prospect of writing a thesis rather onerous, and it is a trial. You do a lot of work that gets scratched out and thrown away or heavily modified, and there can be some painful moments. There are a few ways of mitigating this. First of all, in the actual writing process, I find it's really good to set really good intermediate goals, even down to sort of the weekly level, and have a little reward at the end of each goal, so that when you finish this section, you're going to take yourself out for dinner, something like that. But it's good to really set little milestones so that you feel like you're progressing. The other thing to do that can help a lot is to ask fellow graduate students and postdocs to look at your thesis and advise you as you're going along. This is where postdocs can be really valuable, because most postdocs have written their thesis in the last few years. They know what it's like. They are fundamentally sympathetic, and you know, they haven't seen 15 or 20 of them go by. So I think a lot of professors, you know, myself included, just when you've done a lot of them, it seems like a very routine thing. And for the student, you know, you're doing this for the first and only time, and there's nothing at all routine about it. And so talking to a postdoc or another graduate student in the process of writing about writing and about how it's going is very valuable. Having other people really read and comment extensively can help a lot as well. Someone who's a professor who's done it a lot of times, you know, we give it our full attention and really do our best, but it's something that, you know, we've done, we see as something maybe not routine, but something we've done many times before, and having younger people really provide a fresh perspective can really help a lot. So everything I've said is applicable to a senior thesis. At MIT, physics majors are expected to write a senior thesis, and they're typically somewhat shorter, although some of them can be quite long. And my theory about a senior thesis is that it's not necessarily a statement, a scientific statement. It's more a description of something that the student has done. So I pretty routinely have students who write about instrumentation or some calculation we did, And that's fine. There's nothing really wrong with that. Senior theses are due in May of the senior year, and my strategy always is that the student really does the research for the senior thesis the summer before and really finishes that research by September and spends fall term writing the thesis. So the writing schedule kind of stretches for 3 months. And so that the thesis goes in early in spring term or during IAP, which is the month of January. That way, the student really has spring term off in the sense that they don't have to produce a thesis. And I can tell you, I've seen some just really ugly scenes around, you know, late April, early May, as people struggle to get their senior theses done so that they can graduate. It's really just far better to do these things early and you know, then leave some time for really enjoying your senior year. So the big message about thesis writing is plan ahead, take it slow, and talk to a lot of people, especially your advisor or a close mentor. But your advisor plays a major role in the decision-making. And in general, when given time, people make reasonable decisions. I think people start doing silly things when their deadline's coming up and there's an element of panic in the air. So the earlier you can get it going, the easier it goes. And it should be something, the goal of all of it is at the end of the day to have something that you've written that you're really proud of and can look back later and think of this as something that I really succeeded in doing, that I worked hard at and got a good result. Because the main thing about being a graduate student is that you need to really demonstrate that you can assume command of something. And there's this really kind of interesting phenomenon that takes place sometimes. As the student is finishing their thesis, their whole world turns into, you know, that area of physics. And there's a tremendous amount of enthusiasm and just command of that area. And it's really kind of charming to see someone realize that they can really be an expert in something that's very difficult and that very few people are expert in. So that's writing the thesis. This is the first of a few podcasts having to do with career milestones. The next one is going to be getting a job, getting your postdoc. And then the one after that is getting a junior faculty position, assuming you want one. And I'm thinking after that of saying something about the promotion process and how to think about it. There's huge amounts of mystery surrounding all of these things, and there doesn't need to be. So that's kind of the plan for the next few podcasts. Actually, I should mention that I'm sitting out in a little courtyard by some shops in downtown Santa Barbara. And, you know, there are lots of people yelling, and there's a guy right next to me with one of those cherry pickers. I'm not sure he really knows how to use it. He's about 25 feet above my head and driving the thing back and forth from up there. So if there's suddenly a crashing sound and the podcast just goes dead, that's why. And the only thing I have with me for the mind feed is the 21st of June edition of Nature, which I've read on the airplane now about 6 times. There are a couple of actually very interesting things in it. One of them is an idea to use rotating liquids as a mirror, possibly a mirror on the moon. The idea being that getting a large, sort of maybe 10 meter radius or 10 meter diameter mirror up to the moon would be prohibitively expensive, but you can get a few thousand liters of, for example, mercury up there and spin it and use that as an infrared mirror for an infrared telescope. Now, first of all, why infrared? As you look at more and more distant supernovae, the redshift due to the expansion of the universe is larger and larger. And so the important features of those supernovae are redshifted more and more into the infrared. So I think really kind of the holy grail is being able to have an infrared telescope that's quite large in space. So the Hubble is pretty optical, but the next version, which is the Webb telescope, will be infrared. The idea is to put an infrared telescope on the moon that would be much larger, and because of the stability problems and the problem of getting very large things in the kind of orbit you need. Using the parabolic shape that you get in a spinning liquid as the primary mirror. Now, you know, kind of my immediate reaction to this is like, oh, this is a stupid idea. But, you know, if you don't think about things like that, you'll certainly never do them. And I think there is no doubt that a telescope of that size would be a tremendous boon to cosmology. What this article is about is the idea of coating an ionic liquid with silver. Now, the thing is, you've got this spinning liquid, and it gets a nice parabolic shape, but that's only one element that you need. The other element is you want it to reflect. And there aren't too many liquids that just naturally reflect, aside from mercury. And we all know how desirable it is to have a large mercury mirror, although there's a picture of one. So what these guys have done is found a way of having an ionic liquid that you can float a layer of silver on the surface of to make the mirror. The other thing is about Formula One racing, which I've always found very exciting. Formula One racing is going green. And in fact, the Formula One racing has had a really considerable impact on the car you drive, because in Formula One, what they want is the cars to go about 150 miles an hour on average. And as the cars got faster and faster, they make the requirements on the engine smaller and smaller. So, for example, in the 1950s, the engines were about, you know, between 1.5 and 4.5 liters and generated a horsepower of 270 horsepower. And by the 1990s, the engines are about the same size, about 3 liters, and generate 755 horsepower. And so the competitive nature of Formula One racing is really trying to get the engines more and more efficient. And that feeds down into the rest of the car manufacturing. What they're working on now is trying to go green, trying to really emphasize fuel economy and low carbon emissions. It's kind of an interesting article. It's kind of weird that something like Formula One would take this approach, but it's an interesting idea. So I'll put links to both of those. See, I was also on Nova last night, and there's an Ask the Expert page where you can ask me questions, and I'll post the link for that as well. to Terry Yu for mentioning the podcast on cosmic variance. And a lot of people are starting to send comments, and that's kind of nice. And you can look at them and feel free to send me comments. And I just wanted to mention that I will not use your name unless you specifically ask me to. So just, if you have a comment and you want me to mention you, I'm happy to. Just say so. And the website is going to be improved a little bit, it looks like. So thanks to Sheila Marston and John Marston for that. And thanks to Maynard Galinas and John Thompson in the LNS Computational Facility, and Bonna Newman and Homer Reed in Graps. And this is me in Santa Barbara. And I hope you have a good week in Cambridge or Santa Barbara or wherever you are. Kui e kolono pele kani he, ho'olo heke kui ni o palani e, lava e e kapua iluna e, no kapa ake a he maha kua e, ea ea ea, ea ea ea, lava e kapua iluna ea, no kapa ake a he maha kua. Hai hai a mai ka pua nei, he o ka wani ka wika he no ala. Ea ea ea, ea ea ea. Hai na mai ka pua na ea, ka wani ka wika he no ala. Hai na mai ka pua. Kalani ka mika hei noa.